Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, August 24th, 2026. Thanks for joining us here in the studio. My name is Magnus Stevens and I'm your host for this hour. Coming up throughout the show, we have Stephen Fan is going to be joining us shortly to talk about the trade talks between the United States and Canada that came to a crashing halt on Friday night. We're also going to have Peter R.H. in the studio towards the end of the show, and he'll be arriving shortly. And, of course, as we always do every week, we have our Gardening with Embark segment, and we'll be talking with Pablo Vimas, our gardens expert, about dealing with some of the garden raiders that start showing up around now as all your summer crops and stuff are coming to harvest, and also getting ready, cleaning up the garden to prevent those pests and getting ready for the fall. So all that more coming up today on Speak Up. First, though, here is a short bit from our friends at Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, and Oklahoma have long been considered the heart of Tornado Alley. But Illinois, which historically averages about 50 tornadoes per year, recorded about 200 in just the first half of this year. And in Mississippi, 8 tornadoes hit on a single night in May. Events like this can leave people wondering if climate change is increasing the risk of tornadoes. But Jeff Trapp, a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Illinois, says the answer is uncertain. Data show that tornadoes are getting more frequent in areas east of the Great Plains.
Mississippi and Alabama, Tennessee and Kentucky really pop up, and even southern Illinois and southern Indiana.
And clusters of tornadoes are becoming more common.
On the days that tornadoes do form, there tend to be more tornadoes.
But Trapp says what's driving these changes remains an open question. A warmer atmosphere can fuel strong thunderstorms, which are critical for tornado formation. But tornadoes also require certain wind conditions, and how climate change is affecting those is much more complex. So scientists are still working to understand the links between global warming and these dangerous events. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Perhaps you witnessed the spectacular lightning, thunder and lightning storm that rolled over Vancouver on Saturday night. It was really something. I spent quite a bit of time sitting on my patio. It's all covered in clothes. I'm not in danger of getting struck by lightning. Just watching the storm and the lightning and the thunder pealing around, and then the rain came, quite torrential, enough to cause problems in some areas. The intersection of Cambie and Broadway was flooded to a depth of a few inches, which is kind of incredible. Flooding happened out at YVR too, and of course the thunderstorm disrupted flights for a good chunk of Saturday evening, with the effects of that rolling into Sunday with all the reschedules. Apparently one of the biggest storms we've seen in this area for quite a long time, and it's interesting to look into a bit of the science about why it was so big. It was sort of a confluence of a couple different factors, including the humidity and a front rolling in and stuff like that. So quite the light show and pretty cool to watch. And hope you caught some of it too. In other news, another mill closure is happening, has taken place, well, is going to be happening, has been announced in BC in conjunction with the new tariffs that are being that are now applied as a result of the breakdown in trade talks at the end of last week. Things are not looking great for the BC forest industry. There'll be new tariffs on lumber, and of course the BC forest industry has been laboring for many years under tariffs as well as problems from created by wildfires, but also created by the mountain pine beetle and just a whole host of factors. So difficult times ahead for that. And in the world of trade, of course, as I've mentioned a few times, the negotiations between the U.S. and Canada broke down on Friday night. Here's a bit of from the Prime Minister, Mark Carney, talking about why those talks broke down.
In recent weeks, there had been important progress made towards a possible agreement, an agreement that would have reinforced Canada's position as having the best deal in the world with the United States, including by securing the best terms for each of our most important strategic sectors and by providing greater certainty about our future trading relationship. And while we believed earlier this week that we were moving towards a mutually beneficial agreement, in recent days, the United States proposed new terms that were uneconomic, unfair, and undermined the net benefits for Canada and called into question the reliability of any deal. In short, they asked too much and they offered too little.
And with that, the Prime Minister called back the negotiating team, and things are at an impasse. Here's a little more from Mark Carney's speech on Saturday about a bit of the history and how it is quite challenging to work with the United States on this issue, and particularly Prime Minister. Particularly working with the Trump administration. That clip's not going to run in, so I'm going to go with the other one. This last comment I'm going to play for you is I'm going to jump back to my previous clip, I think. I do have it here now. For whatever reason, that's going to work. Anyway, as part of at the beginning of his speech, he talked about again the issue of the whole negotiating environment with the U.S. administration these days, and these were his comments.
Consistently proposed long-term partnerships, while America has often pursued short-term transactions. The gap between partnership and competitor, unfortunately, has remained too wide in recent days. So last evening, I instructed our negotiators to return to Ottawa. We cannot accept what they've offered, and we will not give what they've asked. Over the past year, the U.S. has imposed a series of tariffs that violate its commitment under our agreement with them in Mexico, so-called CUSMA. The United States has continually changed their rationale for these actions, from fentanyl to taxes on U.S. tech giants to certification of U.S. aircraft to the sharing of tolls of a bridge that Canada built and paid for, to our dairy policy, to provincial decisions not to sell American alcohol during the trade war, to a television advertisement that quoted Ronald Reagan, to smoke from wildfires while they threatened our communities. Another prominent justification for U.S. tariffs has been their claim that since the United States runs, quote, a trade deficit with Canada, we were ripping them off, also a quote. But the U.S.'s narrow merchandise trade deficit only exists because the U.S. buys so much of its energy from Canada. Canada fuels American growth, supplying 99% of their natural gas imports, 85% of their electricity imports, 60% of their crude oil imports. I don't think they want us to stop sending any of that energy. And if you look more broadly at the comprehensive U.S.-Canada trade balance, which includes the many services from finance to entertainment that we buy from the United States, that shows a persistent American trade surplus. Most fundamentally, trade is about building mutual strength, creating a relationship that benefits both countries.
This morning, in a social media post, President Trump announced even more tariffs coming along, with 50% tariffs new 50% tariffs being threatened on the auto industry, on trade vehicles, and a bunch of other industries, which is set to come into effect on January 1st. The Prime Minister, Canada has, through the Prime Minister, has in response to the breakdown and the tariffs imposed starting on Friday night, which were originally announced back in July, will be matching dollar for dollar the $28 billion value of those tariffs on trade, equating to that. And the Prime Minister did make a speech this morning just before we went on air. I didn't actually, unfortunately, have time to listen through to it to develop any analysis of it for you. But one thing he the Canadian position is that the United States has attacked us through trade, and they've been doing that. The Trump administration and Trump have been doing that ever since he took office on January 20th for his second term on January 20th, 2025. And it's been one thing after another. One of the things that has been discussed as one of the reasons for breaking off the talks was that, among other things, the Americans threw onto the table late in the week was some weakening of protections for the French language and cultural protections. And, you know, one of the things you have to wonder is if the Americans are really, and Trump are really trying to stir up trouble on the Quebec sovereignty independence front. Quebec is going into an election very shortly, and I think any weakening or reduction of protections for the French language or the right to protect the French language would land like a bombshell in that provincial election and really create some other problems. And so you have to ask yourself, why would the United States want to do that? Is that really just about trade, or are there more, you know, nefarious reasons? It's often suggested that there is significant U.S. involvement and interference in the referendum process currently underway in Alberta, that there is lots of sort of support and cooperation between the separatist movement there and American influence. So, you know, what is the goal of the United States government under Trump? Is it to destabilize and threaten Canada's viability? A lot of people think so. And, you know, these attacks on our economy seem to be, you know, one way of weakening us and trying to introduce these other issues into and to perhaps try and in some way bolster or strengthen the specter of independence and separation movements is another. It's a depressing sort of prospect that, you know, a nation that was once our best friends is now and continues to be a threat to Canada. One of the last things that, you know, as part of Mark Carney's speech on Saturday afternoon, he made this comment I'm going to play for you. And in many ways, it sums up so much of what it's like dealing with the Trump administration, not just for Canada, but for many others. So I'll give this I'll let you listen to this, and then we'll be back.
We've been under no illusions. We recognized from the start that America has changed. Early last year in this room, I observed that the decades-long process of steadily increasing integration between our economies was over. Our government understood before many that America would transform all of its commercial relationships, that it would put a series of tariffs on its closest allies and use economic integration as a weapon. We recognize that sometimes its signature was written in pencil.
It's that last line that really stands out. Its signature written in pencil. You know, when it comes to international diplomacy and international agreements, and even into the world of business, you know, the saying, and this is an older saying, so it's a bit outdated in its language, but a man is only as good as his word. A person is only as good as their word, which means that, you know, if you agree to something, you know, you need to stand behind it and back it up. That doesn't seem to be the case with this administration, both in terms of how it sticks to the things it claims to have agreed to, it is agreeing to, but even, you know, on its everyday announcements of what its intentions are, what's going on, what it's doing, what it believes. We've seen that in the recent the ongoing war with Iran between the United States and Iran. It seems to be a mild pause moment of a sort. But how many times have we seen Trump's claim that talks are happening or an agreement is in place or it's almost over and it all turns out to be not true? You know, whatever the so-called agreement is at best a concept of an agreement. And increasingly, every time Trump says something, the Iranian leadership comes out and say, no, we haven't agreed to that. That's not true. You know, the idea that a country like the United States can get by in the world when its partners, and even a country the size and power of the United States needs partners, understand that any agreement it creates is written in pencil. It can't be relied on. They'll go back on it as soon as Trump gets some idea in his head or gets mad about something or, I don't know, doesn't get, you know, what he wanted for dinner and has a tantrum. Very weird times for us. So, we'll see. Obviously, this is... Well, it's been a story that's going on for a year and a half since the second term of Trump started, and it's not going anywhere soon, and we will have to see how it goes. More locally, the bus strike action is still ongoing, and drivers are not in uniform, so at the moment no other no disruptions are planned, but it's a symbolic step on the part of the unionized workers of the Coast Mountain Bus Company, which is the sort of subsidiary that runs buses throughout Greater Vancouver for TransLink. And it does sound like they're based on the last statements from the union, that they're not that close on their agreement on resolving the issues in that job action. And we haven't heard any updates in that. I assume that discussions are continuing behind the scenes. We'll see where that goes, hopefully towards a satisfactory resolution. We have school starting not just for us here at SFU, but for everybody starting in about a week and a half. And having a bus strike would be pretty devastating. It'd be really hard for people to get around. SFU in particular is a commuter school. If it elevates to that level, it will be quite a big thing. Hopefully that isn't what happens. Like I say, we're only at, this job action that's happening now with drivers not wearing uniforms is symbolic, just a way for the union and the workers to show, make visible their issues with the employer. And so hopefully we will, that process will continue and to a resolution. If you've lived through a Vancouver bus strike before, you know just how difficult it can be for everybody. There are a lot of people, a lot of workers, and other folks, students and whatnot, who need to get around, who have no other realistic options in transit. When transit is withdrawn, it really makes it difficult. I do know that from the last big strike that happened with actual withdrawal of services, people did step up pretty good in terms of drivers picking people up and offering rides as much as possible. But it's no substitute for a proper system. It's one thing if you have a trip in one direction along a main route that might help you. If you've got a couple transfers you've got to make to get to your destination, that could be quite the nightmare. All right, let's jump into something a little more fun. This is Arlo Parks from her recently released album, United Kingdom, and this is Get Go.
She looks so It's going to be a...
London-born singer-songwriter and poet. That was Arlo Parks from her recently released album, United Kingdom. That track was Get Go. She's got a lot of great tracks. This, I think, her fifth studio album. So if you enjoyed that, check her out. I'm sure she's on all the available streaming platforms. You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Coming to you from the top of Burnaby Mountain. If you want to respond to anything we say here on we talk about here, or you enjoy the programming, or maybe you have a question about a track we played that you didn't quite catch when the host announced it, you can send us a message on our text line. That is, or you can also call the studio too, 778-782-2573. That's 778-782-CJSF. We'd love to hear from you. Hosts love to get some feedback about the program. So if you're listening sometime and you really like what you hear, shoot them a quick message of appreciation. It's you know, the thing about radio is you're here in the studio and you just shoot it out over the airwaves. And you don't always know who's listening or how many folks are listening. So any feedback is super welcome. And we love to hear from you. Whether it's with praise or question, or you want to argue with us, give us a shout. We want to hear from you.
Something curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane. Something every day, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday. You heard that right, Monday. From 3 to 4 p.m. Your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.
Millions of Canadians are living with a brain injury, but millions more don't fully understand the impact it can have. The invisible effects of a brain injury can make everything more challenging. Without recognition, understanding, and care, these challenges only grow. By learning about brain injury, you can show those impacted they're not alone. Find information, access resources, or make a donation at braininjurycanada.ca.
And now it is time for Gardening with Embark, as we bring this to you every week, with our very own gardens expert. Pablo Vimas is here, and that means it is time for Gardening with Embark. Welcome, Pablo.
Nice to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. So it's a nice week out there, and some of the smoke that's been around recently seems to have really cleared away.
Yep.
So that's nice.
That's nice. Nice is to see the sun bright again. Clear, clear sun, clear skies.
We still had a very red sunset last night, but...
Yeah, that's... awesome to have a sunset, a red sunset. Also, if you start noticing, if you wake up and you park your car outdoors,
yeah,
you will see that there is dew on the windshields,
right,
and on top of your car. So it means that the temperature at night is dropping slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And that, as the gardeners tells us, that we are in a transition.
Yep.
Summer is slowly moving into fall. And if you've been living in Vancouver and in Burnaby for a long time, you know that sometimes in 2 weeks,
yeah,
we switch very quick.
Yeah.
And then we are caught like, oh, which I should harvest. I should have done this. I should have done that, because it switched so fast.
Yeah, well, it's funny because, you know, you see that at the beach, right? August, nice day, everybody's at the beach. Labor Day comes, nice day, nobody's at the beach. And it's, you know, it's only a few degrees that makes that difference between what's comfortable and not so great anymore. And
that's right.
And imagine that's the same in the garden.
The same in the garden. Yeah, so the plants start noticing. And we also, in our gardens, we start noticing wildlife,
mm-hmm,
which is interesting. So At the moment, there are lots of white cabbage butterflies.
Right.
Flapping around, visiting the garden. It's awesome to see them.
Mm-hmm. You know, so they're very pretty.
Very pretty, and my garden is attracting wildlife. But remember, at this time, they are also laying eggs because mm-hmm. they want to make sure the next generation has to survive for the butterflies.
Yeah.
So they are laying eggs under the leaves. And if now it's time for us gardeners to go and visit your plants, and if you start noticing some small holes in the leaves, mm-hmm. it means that there is a caterpillar underneath, and they are so tiny. They start very, very tiny, mm-hmm. and the damage is small. It's so tiny little holes inside the leaf. So that tells us there's a caterpillar. Look underneath, and you see a small, tiny, almost translucent caterpillar.
Yeah.
So we had to start controlling. The only thing that organic, super organic, is take your fingers and squish them.
Right. So once you see those butterflies showing up, you need to start looking for those caterpillars, but also the eggs. You can find
yes,
the eggs as well.
The eggs. Yeah. Any eggs that you see at the moment, just squish it. Because yeah. could be eggs of of butterflies or the eggs of aphids, because right. they are also slowly start to showing up. We have beautiful Savoy cabbage. Mm-hmm. And if you have grown Savoy cabbage, you know how wrinkly the leaves are.
Yeah.
Very nice and difficult to apply any pesticide or any insecticide. So
yeah.
even if you apply insecticidal soap, it will just wash away. So yeah. you have to use your hand and prevent that the caterpillars have a feast of your vegetables. So we just noticed that we have those caterpillars in Savoy cabbage, kale, and radishes, mm-hmm. in the leaves of radishes. And if we don't control, we can just lose all our radishes, and particularly in a week time, everything right. will be gone. That's the one thing. The other thing is that we had beautiful, beautiful sunflowers in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful, big sunflowers. They bloomed, and now they were setting seeds.
Yep.
But nature, looking for food. Every creature in the wild is looking for food, fatting it up for the winter.
Yeah.
So those sunflowers are a source of nutrition. Okay. So they came and they climbed up and they ate all the seeds. So you can see the holes on the ground.
Yeah.
And they were not only happy with that, but also the fleshy part of the flower as right. well. They munched on that. And some plants didn't stand, the stems didn't stand the weight of the
yeah.
all the squirrels, so they snapped in half. So everything's on the ground, and then you can see the leftovers of their feast that they have. So, so again, if you were planning to have seeds of sunflowers for the next season, it would have been better if you covered those sunflowers with a kind of mesh or paper bag or a tissue bag in order to collect the seeds and as well prevent the visitors right. enjoy it.
Yeah. I imagine that creates a problem too. Because, I mean, they must miss some seeds, and those end up in the ground, and you know,
yes,
and you end up with errant sprouts next spring.
Yeah, so next spring we might have some sunflowers growing around the garden bed.
Yeah.
The other thing, at the moment, I'm just being positive. Squirrels,
yeah,
but very much can be rats and uh-huh. mice, and again, we don't want to invite those creatures into our garden. So. So we have to be very careful that the garden doesn't become a source of food for the wildlife.
And so what can you do to prevent that? I mean, you know, I see, you know, people, they put, for deer anyway, you know, they put a tall fence around. But yeah. what can you do for a squirrel or other smaller creatures like that?
Okay, so at the moment there is a product that you can buy that is a combination of mint oil, there is pepper oil. Is kind of a granulate that you can spread around the plant, and hopefully that deters, because
yeah.
it affects the sense of the smell.
Yeah.
So chili, pepper, it's not the nicest. And most of the rodents and wildlife, they depend on their nose. So
yeah
that would be one option. The other option would be spraying with a solution of concoction of chili peppers and garlic.
Right.
It's very, very not tasty, but very spicy when you chew on that.
Yeah.
So that would be as well another deterrent for preventing that.
Right.
Your beautiful flowers being raided by the wildlife. So this we notice in the garden. And finally as well, we are noticing that all the flowers, for instance, the cat's ears, which is a wildflower similar to the dandelion, is in bloom again.
Right.
So it will flower, and seeds will be created and disperse all over the game. So
does it create the same sort of, you know, ball like a dandelion does?
They do, yes. Yeah. This puff ball, yes. Yeah. So and that will be seeds all over the place. So again, time to control the weeds. So we don't want to have extra work done over the next spring. And our apple trees, one of our apple trees have problems with spider mites. So they have, you will see very characteristic, is part of the branch of the leaves, they are covered with a web, cobweb, and all that you can see, and they are tiny little creatures just crawling.
So it's very similar to looking to like what you see with tent caterpillars.
Yep. So that's like, okay, so now we need to clean, sanitize that with using, I'm planning to use insecticidal soap, and hopefully I can clean the that section of the branch, and hopefully they don't return. So that is another thing. So as you can see, we are moving. The garden is in a transition, and the environment is in a transition. Wildlife try to set themselves for the next generation, for the next season, and we gardeners have to be in a cleaning and janitorial mode constantly. I know that some of us will be like, oh, I had a heavy summer, we've been watering, we've been harvesting, was like, I want the season done. And sometimes we just forget, you know, and then that leaving the garden as it is, it becomes a heavy work for the spring. And so we at the moment are keeping up. And as well, in our minds is already fall is coming, rain will be here, and it's time to start extending the gardening season by building hoop houses. So again, that's another big task. We have this garden, it will be our second winter in on site, and we want to have all the garden beds protected with hoop houses. So we will be building during October. We will just build hoop houses, and protecting the garden beds, because they are raised garden beds, protecting them from the excessive rain of the fall.
Excellent. Well, it, you know, as we say every week, it's always busy in the garden, but it's also, you know, sometimes being busy is saving you from extra busyness later on, like a lot of tasks, getting ahead, keeping the garden clean, you know, removing the waste, tidying up the weeds.
And somehow as well, keeping the wildlife, but selecting which wildlife you like to keep. One thing that we still notice is the deer. The deer has come and eat all the tomato shoots and the shoots of the beans. And it's interesting because they just go for that plant, even though we have corn, which already has a beautiful ears, and they haven't touched it. Next to the beans, we have beautiful carrots. They haven't touched it, not even nibble the leaf of the carrot, nothing. And finally, here in the garden here at the south side of the Maggie Benston, we have a community area, pinny tables. And this side used to have crows. Well, all across campus there are crows. But this section used to have a bit more concentration of crows. And now I noticed in the last 2 weeks, they have become very bold. So they were bold because they were around, but now they are extremely bold. So if you arrive to a table, to a pinny table, with your lunch, they will just land straight on the table and close and walk towards you.
Yeah. So that's not really, I mean, I like crows, but I wouldn't like that.
No, not like that, because at one point they will start just diving and swiping whatever is in your plate. and that we don't want. I remember that if you had visited a few years back the Vancouver Aquarium, we have the seagulls.
Right.
And then you went to the to collect your food from the counter, until you get to the table, they will just swipe, dive, and take your food.
Yeah.
So we don't want that in here. So and this is open. And so if you are a listener of us and listening to us, please do not feed the wildlife. Do not feed the wildlife. Don't encourage those crows to be comfortable around us when we are eating, because they are very bold now. They just, as I said, they just land on the pinny table and get closer to you like, hey, I'm here.
And probably that's good advice in your own garden too, to just, you know, discourage the wildlife you don't want, but don't encourage too much, you know, everyone else to come by and you know, it's not good for the animals anyway.
Yes, so our food is not good for animals. We know very well that bread is no good for birds. Mm-hmm. They don't digest very well the bread, and we still tend to give them bread.
Yeah.
And the other thing is our food has oils, have vinegar, vinaigrettes, dressings. So it's no good for. And yeah. The other is they become a nuisance. Mm-hmm. So now in the garden, you just arrive there for a resting place, and suddenly you have all this wildlife crowing, shouting like, oh, I'm here, where's the food? and the deer, I noticed as well, the deer, people walk around and they have offered them carrots. You know, from the hands, the deer gets used to be fed by hand, and sometimes you are just walking around and they just get closer to you and expecting that to be fed, and you have nothing, and then there is not this nice feeling, you know, like the animal gets closer to you and you're like, no, you have to keep your distance. Things like that. Hopefully we are going to make more signage inviting everyone not to feed the wildlife.
Well, that's great. Summer's always busy for so many things, but the garden keeps on gardening.
Yes. And so now we'll be moving to fall. Yeah. We just started with our cold crops, kale, cabbages, leeks we've been planting.
Yeah.
So this is the time. If you've been following us, we've been telling week 26, when the school ends, this is the time to start your nursery. Now we are in week 34, so your nursery will be full of plants ready to transplant, if you haven't been transplanting already. So because in 2 weeks' time, the school is open and the garden moves into fall completely. Right. Yeah.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Pablo. Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability. He's here every week as our gardens expert. Tell us more about how people can find out about Embark.
So, Embark is a hub of knowledge and supporting members of the SFU community that are interested in sustainability. And we can find our work in visiting our website at embarksustainability.org and following our social media channels at Embark Sustainability.
Great. Thanks so much, Pablo. See you next week.
See you next week.
And Pablo Vimas will be joining us every week until the end of the gardening season in the beginning of November. So tune in every day about 10:30 to get all the great garden wisdom from there. Don't forget that coming up, lots of great programming coming up here on CJSF, Democracy Now! At 11. We'll be back with a report from Danny Nesvadarani right after this message.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to 2.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvadarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. The Many Voices Project at the Burnaby Village Museum is working towards including voices and perspectives that haven't had the opportunity to be a part of the city's historical record. Originally starting 4 years ago, the Burnaby Village Museum has recently put a call out for more participants to share their experiences living in Burnaby through oral history interviews as part of this project. Eventually, these interviews will become a part of the city's digital historic archive. To learn more about the project, how Burnaby residents can participate, and why it began in the first place, we reached out to Kay Petrusa, assistant curator at the Burnaby Village Museum. Please take a listen to our conversation.
I think one of the main jobs or roles of any museum is to collect information, stories, artifacts, and preserve those things and share those things, make them accessible. So the Many Voices Project is one way that we do that. We use the term oral history. It's kind of an academic term, but the idea being it's interviews with people who want to share their stories. And it's a really great way to broaden our collection. So we treat these interviews like we would an artifact, like a photograph. They are part of the museum's collection. And they really serve to diversify what we have in our collection. You know, the museum has been around for more than 50 years now. So the way we've collected, the people who've been involved with collecting has really evolved in 50 years. So this is an opportunity to reach groups of people that have not previously contributed to the museum at all, or to maybe a smaller degree. It's accessible to people who may not have a physical item that, you know, is deeply imbued with Burnaby history. I mean, we accept and collect things from all walks of Burnaby time. You know, it's not just old stuff. It's these interviews are examples of new contemporary stories that are relevant for Burnaby's history, for Burnaby's present, for the future. Another reason I really like doing this project is because I often do think into the future. So, you know, for example, we have, I would say, a really sizable collection right now of oral histories. And I love thinking of future curators, researchers, designers who will be able to draw on this really rich collection of like an intensively, textured experience of what Burnaby's like right now. And another great thing about it is that people share their contributions, their stories in their own words. So we do contribute, when we have the interview recorded, that audio is available. We also provide a transcript, but having that audio file is just it's very personal. It's in someone's own words, so it's sort of a unique way of capturing history, a rich way to do it.
What was the outreach process like? Like, how do you get people to know that this is an option, this is something that they can contribute to?
Mm-hmm. Lots of ways. I'm proud to say that the project is in its fourth year. And, you know, formally in its fourth year, but the museum has been doing outreach in this way for at least 10. So it sort of started with, at least initially, it started with a group of people that showed an interest in working with the museum. A community such as, well, the Chinese Canadian community came first. There's just, because there was an advisory at the time, an advisory committee, I should say. So a group, a close-knit group of people who had been here a long time and were just interested in sharing their history, getting it documented and sort of in the museum's collection. And it was really successful. And again, we definitely did oral histories. We've got some really great artifacts that came out of that push. And that kind of happened organically. I wasn't at the museum at the time, but that was sort of like the beginnings of it. And since then, there's been different evolutions of working with specific community groups, whether they come forward and say, we're a community, we have something to share, can we share it? The Many Voices Project is a perfect way for that. I mean, we do have other opportunities for really anyone to come forward and be involved with our programs or our community exhibitions call out, but this program I like because it's just always there. It's perennial. It's someone can come forward, an individual can come forward, or a group can come forward. So I guess how we've reached other people in the past, it's been a little bit organic. Sometimes it's been, you know, we also know Chinese Canadian community has been established in Burnaby a long time, but, you know, actually the South Asian community has been established a long time. So why don't we, you know, make a few contacts there? I can't even recall now how exactly that came forward. It might have been a desire on the museum's behalf, with many people very willing to contribute. And the series of oral histories we did during that time actually culminated in an exhibition that was at the museum for 2 years. And so it's happened that way. And I find now, again, that we're this far along. We have a lot of people coming forward now. So it's really, really great to be able to sort of work month in and month out around connecting with these groups. But we also do to what we can on social media, other media such as this, to sort of get the word out. And also we attend community events around Burnaby, you know, Pride and Car Free Day, those kinds of things. So those are really interesting. We reach a very different group of people when we go out into the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, it sounds like people are contributing on their own terms. And that kind of relates to another question I had, which was the, I guess, the format of how these contributions are made, you know, like whether if it's an interview, for example, whether you have like set questions that you ask, or if it's something that someone has a very specific idea in mind of what they want to talk about, and then they just come to you with that, or if it's a mix of both, maybe.
Yeah, it's a mix of both and everything in between. You know, some people, I find some people who hear about the project are just instantly inspired and say, wow, finally, you know, I have a chance. Or more often it's, you know, a friend of a friend who thinks, you know, you have a really great story, you should tell it. Those people sometimes need a little encouragement around, like, well, they'll wonder, well, what is my story? I don't have a story. I've been here for a while. I like it, you know, so it takes a bit of time to talk those out. So in the case of someone that they're not really sure if it's for them, or they're not really sure if they're the right person, I think the way we kind of define it is, if you have a connection to Burnaby and you want to share it and sort of contribute to the historical records in perpetuity, that's more or less the criteria. So if someone's feeling a little bit like they don't know where to start, we usually meet with the person in advance. So sometimes, you know, media interviews is sort of like you're on and you go. But this is, we often will take the time in advance to just sort of meet with the person first and say, well, who are you? You know, it's just sort of general life story questions. That's generally how it goes. But in the case of, say, a certain community group, sometimes there is a thread, especially if we know this group of interviews will end up in an exhibition. Sometimes when you know as a community you're working towards an exhibition and you're going to be physically on display in the museum as well as online, we have done more structured interviews. You know, we'll always include sort of the life history, but we also include, you know, sometimes more specific things around, say, for example, if the community is known for textiles or a particular art form, or the community is known for being having come from a war-torn country, like how much do they want to speak about that? Or are they as a group trying to sort of change the narrative that they see in the media or out in the world, that they have the chance to sort of retell it or tell it in a different way or provide a different perspective? So it really depends on the person. I mean, the community collections are nice because it's a really, again, a really deep and rich textured snapshot. But the one-offs are great as well, especially because we've been doing this long enough now that something that comes across as sort of a random happenstance contact is now starting to plug into other stories we have or other collections that we have. So it depends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's like a very broad view of Burnaby in a sense. I mean, both in obviously like the identities that are presented, but then also just in the way that it's presented as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, currently we're always pursuing people with a connection to Burnaby, and we're always collecting material for the museum. But at this very moment, we are working with the Armenian community in Burnaby, which has had a cultural center in Burnaby for 50 years, which I hadn't known that previously. And we're also looking for the queer experience in Burnaby. So if there's that one, you know, we know maybe more about Vancouver's queer history, but the Burnaby one is sort of quieter, a little more unknown. So that's been interesting. And also the working waterfront. So Burnaby has Burrard Inlet along the Fraser River, and even Still Creek. They've been industrial areas for about 100 years or so. And so that's kind of a long time. And if you look at the history of like the physical geography or urban geography of Burnaby, it's changed so, so much in 100 years. But for me, I feel like the way our waterfronts look and the contributions of industry has really remained relatively stable. Some people might disagree with that, but from sort of an outsider view, from someone who's curious, the physical space and the land use as well has been stable. So we don't know an awful lot about that, but really interested in anyone who's worked on the waterfront, whether it's in along sawmills, logging, energy resources, shipping now. So those are sort of three focuses.
How can people who are interested in just the stories being shared through this access it in the first place?
The easiest way is to go to Heritage Burnaby. You could just Google that phrase and you'll find it. And if you go to our homepage, there's a tile that says Oral History Collection. So you'll get access to our entire, what's basically what is available and online and sort of ready to go. So if you want to peruse, you can search by community, you can search by keyword. But the search function is quite good if you know what you're looking for, but it's also not such a huge collection that you could probably just browse, you know, over the few pages. But Heritage Burnaby is the place to go and listen and see what we've done so far.
Mm-hmm. And right now there's just an active call for more people to contribute, correct?
Yes, there's always an active call, and those three sort of topics I mentioned, we're especially interested, and there's some momentum there. Yes.
Those were the main questions I had regarding the Many Voices project, but if there's anything we didn't touch on that you think is worth mentioning that people should know about, please do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I just like, I sort of already said this, but I just like to underscore that this project is... It's contributing to the museum's collection. I think sometimes people think of museums as basements with old things, which is not untrue. But we do more than that. We're always collecting. We're always sort of trying to record and make contributions to the historical record and share those contributions. So I see that project like that, and I think sometimes that's a little harder and more intangible for people to understand. But also just to encourage people to contact me or contact the museum if you have questions, if you're not really sure, if you want to just kind of explore. Like we interview people that have a connection to Burnaby, so even if you think, oh, I've only been here a year, but I've done all these things and I intend to do these future things. Like that works for us. You know, it's, I would just invite people to think about, their own stories and how they probably are quite relevant, to what we're looking at, because we're looking at Burnaby and we're looking at documenting it now, for future historians, researchers, and scholars.
Once again, that was our interview with Kate Petrusa, the assistant curator at the Burnaby Village Museum, on the Many Voices project, which has put a call out for more participants to share their experiences living in Burnaby through oral history interviews, which will then be included in the city's historical record for those to access online. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This interview would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.